This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, lie about language's whereabouts. In today's episode, as the climate changes, so does the vocabulary around it. To amplify concern, to dampen concern, to serve corporate concerns. There's a whole lot going on with it. All right, on with the show.
To be honest, I think I'd get rid of most of the words in the climate change conversation. I'd just quite like to start again.
One of the big problems about working in climate change is that I think we still have quite a limited vocabulary in terms of how do we talk about this. And because it's scary, because it's abstract, we have all those extra challenges about how are we going to talk about this anyway.
Alice Bell here has to talk about it, though, because she's Director of Communications at the climate charity Possible and the author of the new book, Can We Save the Planet?
Climate change has been allowed to stay a bit dormant in terms of language change and just culture generally, because we've been avoiding talking about it. And I'd say that we are generally quite inarticulate when it comes to climate change, but we have seen the power of new phrases helping unlock some new conversations. In the last year in particular, climate crisis, I think, is one of them.
In May 2019, The Guardian newspaper announced that they were updating their style guide to replace the term climate change with climate emergency, crisis or breakdown.
Guardian has said it's their style guide now to say that, and to say global heating rather than global warming.
What's the difference between global heating and global warming?
I'm not entirely convinced that there is that. I'm not a global heating skeptic, and I believe it is happening. However, I'm just skeptical that that phrase is going to catch on, but we'll see. I still think it looks a little bit odd.
Maybe warm doesn't sound hot enough to make people scared.
I think that's part of it. It's questionable about whether these words will be enough to scare us, or whether fear is actually the action that we want to trigger. I think one of the reasons for using climate crisis rather than climate change is that people want to alert other people to the fact that it is a problem and that they should be worried. There's a piece of kind of environmental psychology that a lot of us in climate change campaigns use, which is this idea that if you hear a fire alarm, or even if you smell smoke, you probably won't act until you see other people starting to act.
Because you assume it's a practice.
Yeah, it's not the alarm itself that's what sets you off. It's watching other people run in with water. And there's lots of things you can do to be that signal in the world of being someone running in with water to help other people realise that it's real and make it real and that it's something they need to be worrying about. But saying climate crisis rather than climate change is one of those things. And I don't think it's going to work on its own. There's sometimes a tendency in campaigners to be like, if I find this perfect phrase, it's going to unlock action and then we'll live in a utopia. And I don't think language works like that, but it will play a role. It's not that it has no power at all.
Sometimes that power has been to play down the problem of humans' climate impact.
Language actually comes into this a lot. There's so many ways that the industry has tried to use mucking with language as a way to really kind of own and shape the story. My name is Amy Westervelt, and I'm a captain of industry. No, I'm just kidding.
You got an oil derrick in your back garden.
Yes, I'm a corporate titan. My name is Amy Westervelt, and I'm a climate journalist and a podcaster who does the podcast Drilled.
Drilled is a podcast about the creation of climate denial. Not the denial of the existence of climate, but the denial that climate has been changing in a negative way and that humans are the primary cause.
Even the term climate change was something that PR guys came up with. A right-wing PR guy, Frank Luntz.
Frank Luntz didn't coin the term. It had been around for a few decades already. But when he was working for George W. Bush's administration in the early 2000s, he encouraged this linguistic shift.
With the sole purpose of making climate change seem less dangerous because they thought it sounded better than global warming. They thought it sounded more natural, you know, like it's just a natural phase. It happens. It's not necessarily human. There's no like, you know, active verb happening like warming. It's just change, man. It happens. So yeah.
Frank Luntz has since disavowed this move.
Language and climate is a really interesting topic because
hopefully
it is a space on all sides, but definitely in the journalism realm too, that's been largely shaped by the industry, the oil industry, and therefore kind of softened in all these weird ways that you almost don't even notice until you like think about it again, you know? Why was it so effective?
Do you think it's because people wanted to believe it because believing the reality is very uncomfortable? and terrifying.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think it's a much more pleasant thing to think that, oh, climate change has just been made up by a bunch of people who are like getting rich off of solar, or like a bunch of hippies who hate capitalism, you know, than that it's a real thing and that a lot of the things that we like to do contribute to it, and that the impacts, if we don't change pretty dramatically the systems that govern how we live, are going to be catastrophic. That's, I think people have a real hard time dealing with radical change in general. Actually, radical is another really interesting term as it's used in the climate space. This idea of any action, it has been sort of painted as radical, but like the inaction was also very radical, you know?
Do you think the word alarmist is used to dismiss
Yes.
people as well?
Yes. One of the most effective strategies that the fossil fuel industry uses is to label their opponents with these words that, you know, start to take on negative meanings. If you look at the data on climate and you're concerned about it, you're an alarmist. The whole way that people will use, you know, moderate or pragmatic, I think, is very problematic, you know, because usually it refers to doing the least possible thing, which is actually kind of radically irresponsible at this point, not moderate at all. And also there's this whole thing that happens where the sort of moderate, quote unquote, moderate approach gets cast as basically like not taking a view, you know, like, oh, well, I think we should do something, sure, but I'm not an extreme climate person, or I'm not a climate alarmist. But actually, that's still a viewpoint. There's no default position where you're not actually still taking a position. Even if you're saying we shouldn't do anything on climate at all, like that's still, that's a very clear position, and it's very extreme at this point, you know?
There's a phrase which is often used in the kind of green energy debate, which is like, let's have a green revolution. And I think an interesting thing about that word is it sounds brilliant if you're from a slight more left-wing political persuasion. But one of the interesting things about the climate change conversation is it's become extremely politically polarised, often for not very good reasons.
This is Robin Webster, Senior Climate Engagement Strategist for the climate communication organisation Climate Outreach.
And the word revolution, if you come from a more conservative perspective, is terribly off-putting. So we could be using language where we talk about continuity, we talk about avoiding waste, we talk about not losing our landscapes. All of that language can be really, really powerful and important to somebody of more conservative political background. But the word, people should stop using the word revolution, because it means so much and it shouldn't be used flippantly. And you should think about what it means to people from all sorts of different backgrounds.
So try and use words that suggest a significant change that's a positive one, not a traumatic one.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of these words are just thinking about, what does this word mean to somebody who's different from me? And it's often very difficult for us to think about that, to just put ourselves simply in someone else's shoes and think, how can I say the same thing in a slightly different way, in a way that's not going to sort of set off all sorts of alarm bells in somebody else's head?
Or not ring any bells in someone else's head, because they have no idea what you're on about.
I am as guilty as any, having worked as a techie professional in this for a long time, of writing those sentences that go, by 2050, the trajectory of the curve will be moving in this, and carbon capture and storage. You know, these paragraphs that just mean nothing to nobody, and they're about things which are far away in time, far away in place. We were using these words like sustainability and trajectory and parts per million. And I was like, what on earth is this language? Like, it doesn't say anything.
Parts per million.
Yeah.
That's the stuff to get the people, you know, up and ready for action.
450 parts per million, let's go.
As well as the specialised technical and scientific vocabulary perhaps being alienating or perplexing or even boring, Robin thinks discussions about climate have often had the wrong focus.
The climate change debate has been couched in a conversation about energy a great deal. And it's true that fossil fuels are the major driver of climate change. Of course, that's scientifically accurate. But part of the other things which are about the way we live our lives, about our relationship with nature, about the things around us on a day-to-day basis, got slightly lost from that conversation. And it became a kind of esoteric debate about the development of different sorts of renewable systems, which is very far from what most people want to know about or think about in their daily lives.
Alice Bell also has a problem with the term renewable energy.
So that comes partly from the difference between one that has a finite resource and one that can renew itself. totally makes sense. Except that the problem with fossil fuels now isn't that we're going to run out of them. So for decades, people were worried about what we would do if we ran out of coal. You see people first researching solar and wind in the 19th century. And partly that was because they could tell how damaging coal was, because you couldn't tell how damaging it was to the climate, but it still caused lung disease and made everything sooty and made your clothes really dirty. And people didn't like the grubbiness of coal, and so were looking for alternatives. But they were also like, well, logically, we're going to run out of the stuff. But the problem we now know is that if we burnt even a small amount of the stuff that we know about, let alone the stuff that we haven't really worked at, there might still be more that we haven't found yet, or we haven't found ways of accessing yet. The fact that we're going to run out of it is the last of our problems, basically. So renewable is maybe not the right phrase.
And the reason why I think I don't like the word renewable is it's a techie word. Like, renewable energy is a tech conversation. And I think the climate change conversation just really has suffered from being a tech conversation.
How do you feel about the word green?
That's an interesting one. I mean, I don't know. You know, it's useful sometimes, and it's an easy, short word that people found convenient, but it's been used so much more by industry that it just sort of has that taint to it, you know? I'm pretty much always suspicious when someone pitches me on something that's like the green blah, or even eco-friendly, because I just feel like usually it's a kind of like a product sales tactic, or like a product marketing term. So, yeah.
And it's soft again.
And it's soft.
You know, eco-friendly, it might be better than some of the alternatives, but it doesn't mean it's good.
Yeah, exactly.
And then people use clean energy. And then you're like, well, is it that clean, really?
Yeah, that one's quite depressing as well. There's lots of very good reasons to use the word clean in the context of clean energy, as in it sort of has lots of amazing resonances. You know, it's true, and the concept of kind of clean energy as opposed to dirty energy. So in climate change communications, the word clean is used a lot in the context of energy. But I think, a bit like sustainable, it's kind of lost its meaning. And also it's a little bit too judgmental.
It sounds moral, doesn't it?
Yeah, and this kind of idea of kind of moral judgment is something that's really embedded in the climate change conversation and terribly damaging. And I don't know if you ever had that experience of if you start talking to somebody about being interested in this kind of issues and suddenly you become sort of like their conscience embodied, their conscience on legs, and they suddenly say, yes, I've only flown once in the last year, you know, because there's this feeling of blame, of personal blame that's really embedded in this conversation, which stops people engaging with it.
Oh, good, good. The vocabulary is too technical for people to engage with, or too guilt-inducing to engage with. The language around climate is fraught, even for the professional climate communicators like Alice Bell.
So one of the things, like, I was talking about this with a colleague earlier, and she was saying, you need to be careful about using the word fossil fuels. It's something that some research has suggested that we should be wary of, because wow, that automatically gets you labelled for some communities as an activist, because it shows that you've got an interest. Whereas if you say coal and oil and gas, that's a more general term. But fossil fuels is seen by some people as being something that just activists say.
That's weird, because coal and gas are more specific terms.
Yeah, I mean, so they could be. But I mean, I think there's just, you get different communities that will look at different terms in different ways.
The term fossil fuels sounds like your car is fueled by liquid dinosaurs. But before fossil meant the relics of ancient organisms, it had a different sense. More than 400 years ago, it just referred to things that had been dug out of the ground. And that's the meaning that lingers in fossil fuels. Anyway, maybe non-renewable resources might be a more fitting term.
I really feel like we need to come up with a different term entirely for natural gas. It just sounds so beautiful and good.
Greenwash, noun. Disinformation disseminated by an organization so as to present an environmentally responsible public image. A term coined in 1986 by American environmentalist Jay Westervelt. No relation to Amy Westervelt here.
It's been well known since the early 90s that natural gas comes with very heavy methane emissions. And methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas than CO2. So for whatever it cuts on CO2, it more than makes up for in methane. But because it was branded as this perfect, like, bridge between fossil fuels and alternative energy, like solar and wind and whatever, it's been very, very hard to shake that idea, and that reputation really enables a lot of bad policymaking that delays the very big shifts that need to happen to actually act in a meaningful way.
I mean, I think there's something interesting sometimes about words that have just been used for so long within a debate that they've lost their meaning, even if they had a really decent meaning in the first place. I am terribly bored of the word sustainable. It's a word that arose in the 1990s, and it was about, if you get it into the guts, sustainability is about trying to find a future. And it's been turned and kind of manipulated, and often it means sustainable, as in people use it in the phrase of sustainable business, as in let's keep sustainably doing the same thing. And it's just a word that has been battered to death.
When I see sustainable, I often think it's jargon, something that corporate sustainability people might use because they are a sustainability person.
It's really interesting, actually. I think the terms definitely changed. It was greenhouse effect, then global warming, then climate change. Climate change was like when the industry took charge of the language. And so this emergence of climate crisis is really a key indicator that that era is ending, which is good.
The greenhouse effect was identified in the 1820s by French scientist Joseph Fourier, but it was described in different metaphors then: hotbox, leaky vessel, solar oven, until the start of the 20th century, when in 1901, the Swedish meteorologist Nils Ekholm wrote a paper comparing the atmosphere to the glass of a greenhouse. And then in 1909, the English scientist John Henry Poynting wrote the first known use of the phrase greenhouse effect. But
it's not actually a very good metaphor. So if you talk to a climate scientist, they'll be like, it's not a greenhouse. And so I think that's one of the reasons why you've stopped seeing it so much. So like when I learned about climate change at school, it's probably similar to you. You probably had a little diagram in your textbook of the earth in a little greenhouse looking a bit hot. You'd have these cartoons, you sometimes see them in campaign materials, that sort of like thing. And I think scientists saying it's not really work like that, it's kind of more like a blanket. Although I find if I talk to scientists about this, they're like, it's like a blanket, but like a wet, warm blanket. And I think this doesn't sound very nice. And also, I don't think that's helping me think about the earth heating up if it's a wet blanket. For most of us, it doesn't really matter if the mechanism for heating is something to do like a greenhouse or like a blanket. But it's quite a poor metaphor, so it's kind of weird that that's what we talk about.
Is it like if someone's wet the bed and the moist mattress is warming up, but not in a good way?
Maybe I'll try that on some people next time. Yeah, I have to explain.
Let's try that. Climate bedwet.
Bedwet, yeah.
You're welcome.
See, putting it into terms people can understand and identify with. Although the downside there is, while euphemisms help us digest ideas that we otherwise might be too daunted or terrified by, they can also lull us too much.
It's been a terribly euphemistic conversation, but we have seen this enormous evolution over the last 12 months. And I think the sort of protest that erupted last year did us an enormous favour in terms of language, because they really did start to shift this kind of phrases around climate emergency and climate crisis, have, I think, entered the lexicon and made people feel something different in response to when they hear that language. And I think that is really important.
Feelings. Gotta get people in their feelings.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this thing of it, ultimately it being a scientific discipline, that's originally where the kind of language of climate change has come from. And this sort of facts and figures based information does kind of enter a certain part of our brain, you know, it enters the rational part of your brain, not the emotional part of your brain. And I think we have needed language to enter the emotional part of your brain. We often find that when we sort of talk about the stories that we've experienced as people, how we became concerned about climate change, what we're doing about it now, that's a lot more powerful to other people than sort of hearing about all the what you know about sea level rise in 2050 or whatever.
Aside from sharing stories rather than graphs, there are terms which facilitate communication about climate.
We've seen like plant-based foods, flight shame, climate crisis. These things have not in themselves changed the world, but have started to give us a few more tools to talk about climate change. Flight shame, it's really interesting to look at that working across Europe and how different countries have different words for that in their own languages. The fact that you've got a term for it has helped journalists write about it and then people talk about it. And people thinking about limiting their flight has become a bit more viral just because we have a language about it. There is research that shows that if you cut flying and do for environmental reasons and talk to about it with your friends, they are more likely to cut their flying too, and to also support policy changes to have more sustainable travel. So like, we know that talking about flying is really powerful. And so words that can allow us to do that more are really important.
Up until very recently, we talked a lot about the idea of climate silence, about the idea that people are not having conversations about climate change because it's almost like we created some kind of social agreement that it wasn't polite to do so.
Right.
Well, it is uncomfortable to think about, you know, wrecking the world.
Yes, exactly. There was an interesting set of principles where people were saying no doom and gloom in the climate change conversation. Let's not talk about the impacts of climate change. And Extinction Rebellion last year sort of came along and blew some of that out of the water, which was extremely interesting. And I think one of the reasons it did is this idea that you sort of pairing negative impacts with the idea that there's something that you can do. And also because we're now living in a moment where we can authentically and truthfully talk about the impacts of climate change and see them happening in the world around us, and people are becoming more aware of that. And I think people get really stuck on this idea of, you know, how do we talk about the negative stuff? And I think what we're seeing from what's around us and from the research is you can talk about the negative stuff so long as it's paired with a feeling that there's somewhere to go with it, something that you can do with it, a community to become a part of, something that you can do. And then as people were able to kind of activate those negative emotions and do something with them.
Alice and Robin both told me that if you work in climate, people fall over themselves to express contrition for the flights they've taken or the beef they've eaten.
I think a lot of people who work in climate change find this. They find that people like to confess to them. Something that's happened more and more recently. There's a climate writer recently who said she feels like she's some kind of climate nun because people come and confess to her. She's like, I am not going to absolve you of your sins. However, I'm actually okay with the fact that you've done this thing or that thing, because I'm, for all that I want really big, ambitious climate action, I'm not going to complain about your recycling. So maybe letting people know that you're not going to judge them. But part of that can probably be best signaled by just listening and seeing where they're coming from. And if they need to express that guilt, maybe letting them. But equally, letting them know that they don't have to do that. And if they're talking about things that they're doing that are positive, being interested and letting them talk about that enthusiastically, I think is really important. And sometimes you need to not think about it to get through the day. But also you need to be able to think about what you can do to take action and how you can have a positive impact, and sort of balancing the like fear with the courage.
We said, what's the biggest challenge that stops you having a conversation about climate change? And a lot of people said, I don't know what to do about it. And then conversely, we also found the people that were having the most conversations were often using their own experience of what they, you know, there were people that were able to say, well, I've decided to cycle with the kids to school rather than take the car, or I've slightly changed my diet, and all these things. And they didn't have to be massive changes, but they were changes that are sort of a part of somebody's identity. And you sort of shift and then you feel, well, I'm doing a practical thing, and therefore I can talk about my practical thing in the context of this conversation. And then it becomes a slightly less terrifying conversation. What you do by yourself, it feels insignificant. And I think as people, we're drawn to doing things with other people, and our sense of identity is built by how we see ourselves and also what we see other people doing. So don't feel like your own actions are insignificant, because actually they're often very significant to the people around you.
Once people have stopped trying to absolve their climate sins, if you work in climate change, after they've like told you all the times they've eaten beef, they then ask you, what gives you hope? And I might answer with stuff with gives me courage, and tell them that's a difference, and invite people to think about what gives them courage, what gives you climate courage, what lifts your spirits and makes you think, I can get on with the day, I can be part of something, I can do this. It's about thinking about positively about the future rather than feeling really bad about the past.
Alice Bell is Director of Communications at the climate charity Possible and the author of the new book Can We Save the Planet? Robin Webster is Senior Climate Engagement Strategist for the climate communication organisation Climate Outreach. Amy Westervelt is a climate journalist, and she makes the podcast Drilled. And coming up in today's mini-illusionist, we consider another euphemism, climate denier, as well as fake greenness. AstroTurf, noun. Artificial turf, originally called chemgrass. Astroturfing, noun, the deceptive tactic of simulating grassroots support for a product, cause, etc., undertaken by people or organizations with an interest in shaping public opinion.
This practice is called astroturfing, and they will create fake advocacy groups that sort of look like they're consumer advocacy groups but are actually funded by industry. I don't know. I feel like anytime you see something that's like consumers for freedom or like drivers for safe vehicles, you know, like these sort of, I don't know, it's hard to explain, but I sort of, every time I see one, I'm like, is that really a consumer group? I mean, you see it in like the plastic realm too, where they were trying forever to brand plastic pollution as marine debris. Anytime I see that, anytime I see a nonprofit that's like, we're trying to reduce plastic globally, and then they talk about it as marine debris, I'm like, oh, this is probably an industry-backed front group.
Oh.
And it almost always is. But you can also spot them by, like, you know, if their cause seems like something that, average people probably wouldn't take the time to organize around, then it's probably an industry group. Like on the plastic side, there's the Save the Plastic Bag Coalition, which I find like the most hilarious example that, like, there's tons of consumers out there that are just like agitating for plastic bags, you know?
Well, some people got to be edgelords.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, on the climate side, if you see people that are pushing things like sensible solutions or bipartisan pricing on carbon or bringing industry to the table, like all of that stuff, it's usually an industry group. They've also totally picked up on the whole like civility, civil discourse, like can't we all just get along kind of thing. Like the new American Petroleum Institute ads are all like, you know, we all need to come together and come up with a sensible solution on climate change. It's like, okay, but you guys pretended it didn't even exist up until like 2 years ago. So
do they mean a sensible solution that allows them to carry on exactly as before, exactly, but not feel bad about it?
Exactly, yeah. Also, actually, another good thing to look at too is like I see this on the solution side a lot. If it's a solution, in air quotes, that basically doesn't require the fossil fuel industry to change at all, then it's probably something that's been like where the research and development has been funded by industries.
Euphemisms came up earlier in the show, and here's another: climate denier.
I don't feel like the term climate denier is a super powerful term, you know?
It feels a little too generous, where they're like, you know, I just don't buy it.
Yeah.
Rather than they are dangerously steering in the wrong directions.
And then somehow that's been adapted to climate skeptic.
A lot of climate change deniers have been really offended by the word denial and its connotations and have preferred to use the word skeptic. So that's been a whole little fight all by itself.
People who might self-define as a skeptic started complaining about being called deniers because they said that it was done deliberately to associate them with Holocaust deniers and it was done to tarnish their names. At which point people turned around and went, no, there's all sorts of deniers. We weren't trying to do that. But then some people were like, oh, we don't want to hurt your feelings. And we're not, obviously we're not doing that. And so started calling them skeptics because they felt that was more accurate. And then you get people going, well, I'm not a skeptic, I'm a warmist. So there are very few people who are outright deniers of climate change. Almost no people who believe that. And even the people who've been really quite hardline climate skeptics are moving more towards now saying, oh yeah, there's a bit of warming. It's just not as bad as everyone says it is. They're sometimes known as climate warmists.
I don't know. Why not just liar? Liar is fine. Propagandist, that's good too.
But I mean, the people who are really evil are the people who do believe in climate change. The people who genuinely know, they've had research since the 60s. They funded some of the best early research in climate change because they worked at the companies that knew they needed to do that. And they are still funded work to try and seed doubt in other people's minds. They're not themselves necessarily skeptics. They believe in it. That's why they're worried about it.
Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is jouissance, noun, French, formal, pleasure. I think that means the term is formal, not that the pleasure itself is formal, whatever that would be. Jouissance. Try using it in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman, with help from Martin Austwick, who also provides the music for this show. You can find his work at palebirdmusic.com. Thanks to Rekha Murthy and Jim Futner. And special thanks to Gary O'Connor and Leia, ace supporters of Radiotopia. The Illusionist will be on a bit of a hiatus until May, so I can work on more languagey intrigues for you, plus to take the break that a number of you advised me to have after you heard me on Zigzag Podcast's episode about burnout last year. In the meantime, listen to my other podcasts, Veronica Mars Investigations, and Answer Me This. Keep in touch on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. I'm Allusionist Show on there. And do hear every episode, read transcripts, see the full dictionary entries for the randomly selected words, including etymology, and any and all Allusionist matters. Visit the show at its forever home, theallusionist.org.